This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. Josh Lerner is a professor of investment banking at Harvard Business School, and he's thought a lot about how corporations invest money in research and development. Who's doing it right? Who's stuck using methods that are no longer working? He tackles those questions in his latest book, The Architecture of Innovation, The Economics of Creative Organizations. And Josh Lerner is here. Thanks for coming in and joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
So let me first start with what you start with in the book, which is the story of two acquisitions. People are going to know these companies. Google's acquisition of most of Motorola and eBay buying Skype. Why start with that story, and what does it tell us?
Well, I think one of the crucial things is that it's not just simply a matter of putting money in and getting stuff out automatically. I think we're so conditioned to think about a pipeline where you just sort of put things in the beginning, and then magically the innovation comes out. And I think when we look at the story of Motorola in particular, what we see is that not only did they have leadership in the cell phone market, but they also spend enormous amounts of resources trying to translate that into ideas, but they ended up being absolutely miserable in terms of getting a real bang from the buck or real energy from it. And I think a lot of the problem was they just focused on much more incremental changes, much more small things. The great example to me is that they had rewards for people for taking out patents, and essentially you would get a silver badge, and then you'd get a gold badge, and you could get a platinum badge based on how many patents you'd file.
And you describe people sort of walking around Motorola's headquarters with their badges on. I mean, it sounds like the Pentagon or something, depending on how many patents they had filed.
You definitely wanted that platinum badge. And yet, so as a result, they got lots of patents. People loved filing patents. But the most incremental stuff, the most minor stuff, would end up being the stuff that people would file patents on because you'd get more awards. So the great example is the latch that holds the battery inside
right.
the cell phone. And essentially, they had more than 50 patent filings on that latch alone. And of course, meanwhile, we know what was happening, right? Smartphones were appearing, and we can now do all the wonderful stuff like updating our Facebook status in real time from our phone. And they were stuck with the dumb phone. And essentially, while they were rearranging the deck chairs, the ship was definitely heading downward.
Okay, so, and then how do you contrast that with Skype, which was a lot more of a kind of upstart idea of a few guys that really, really took off?
Absolutely. This is sort of a much more funky story where they had sort of began with their earlier technology, which is basically had been Kazaa, this pirate music sharing site. And they realized that, I guess they got tired of having music industry executives chasing them around the planet trying to serve subpoenas on them, and said, we can do something with this technology that's legal and actually is going to create more value from us. And they got the idea of saying we can use this notion of a distributed network to essentially do phone service and later on video conferencing with a very lean team with just, the programmers in the Baltic and these guys sort of running around and so forth, and a few venture capitalists who were willing to nurture them and dribble out money in small pieces, they were able to create a company which was, essentially a multi-billion dollar entity. So once again, it's not just simply a matter of money in. A lot of it is how the money gets deployed and how that ends up being transformed with the kinds of incentives that people get.
So I'm really interested in this idea of investment and creativity. In addition to Motorola, you talk about Nokia,
right,
which in the years before the iPhone was released, outspent Apple on phone-related research, not by a little bit, but by about 10 times more. So Apple hardly spent anything. Nokia spent a ton, and yet Apple then proceeded to completely crush them in the cell phone market. Why is that? I mean, why didn't Nokia's investment pay off? Were the people just less creative? What happened there?
The amazing thing is that within Nokia, not in 2007 when the iPhone was introduced, or even 2006, but even as early as 2001, a lot of the germ for the notion behind the iPhone and the iPad, or the technology we now recognize as being associated with those two, was already there. In fact, they even had a group that was doing a lot of this advanced product development. But what ended up happening was that there was so much success associated with the traditional phones, the traditional products, that a lot of the power as to how money got allocated and spent was essentially put in the hands of the people who had the existing product line. And the upstarts, the guys who had the new technology, were jumping up and down with excitement saying, look at these prototypes, look at how powerful they would be. But they never got the attention and the resources within the organization that they needed to make that transformation, that they were too stuck in their ways in terms of because in some sense they were victims of their own success.
So that wasn't their cash cow. So people said, well, you may have this new interesting thing, but we focus on what brings in the bucks.
Absolutely.
Okay. But I guess my question is then what allowed Apple to see around the corner to do something different that obviously captured people's imagination?
Right. Well, I think that's, obviously a complicated question. And if we could put it in a bottle and serve it out, it would be wonderful. But I think that certainly one of the crucial things is that Apple ran its research efforts much more in the spirit of how a venture capital firm might organize things, where there was very much a sense of what not the profits of today are, but what the future potential is going forward. And there was a willingness to invest not with an eye to right now, but in the eye to 2, 3, 4 years hence, with a very clear vision of how the future was going to evolve.
And we should say venture capitalists are really people, like you were saying, who are looking for that next big thing, not the company that's already big, not the phone that's already successful, but the gadget that may be successful around the corner.
Exactly. That in a way, when we sort of look at how innovation is funded around the globe today, we really see two models that are really the standouts. You've got the corporate model, the big R&D, which is
research and development, these big labs, you put a lot of money in.
The ivory tower kind of
model.
And on the other hand, you've got the lean venture capital backed startup, where it's much more often of an intuitive kind of basis, where it's really looking towards the future and where the opportunities will be 2, 3, 4 years hence. And in some sense, each of these models is very powerful at doing some things, but each has some very real limitations as well.
Now, let's say you were studying Nokia's failure and Apple's success. A lot of people might wonder, and I certainly wondered, okay, well, is there an inherent problem with throwing a lot of money at something and saying, here are a bunch of people, you guys go try to figure out what's next, what's going to be the next big thing? Whereas Apple, from everything I've read, is sort of led by a very few people who really make the decisions about what the next product looks like. And that product is pretty secretive, pretty much under wraps. Even though Apple's a large company, it's a very tightly held. Is there a problem in opening it up to a large group?
Well, I think that there's, sadly, both good things and bad things about it. When you think about the sort of classic kind of large organizations that did research, the AT&T, which had the Bill Labs, which had so many Nobel Prizes coming out of it, or IBM Central Research, these were, in some sense, very loose organizations where you had all these incredibly smart people sharing ideas. There was a lot of cross-fertilization as people talked to each other. Many of these projects took 5, 10, even 20 or 30 years to develop, and yet it's clear they did some amazing things, like the development of a transistor, which essentially ushered in the whole information technology revolution. So in some sense, you can say that's absolutely fabulous. The problem is that if you don't quite have the A-team, if it's you don't have a clear vision of where you're going, and particularly if you have a setting where people aren't getting a lot of rewards for making those discoveries, as often has been the case, you end up with often a a little bit like a flavor of people coming into work, punching the time card, doing their thing for 8 hours. You don't have that kind of intensity and creativity, that kind of hothouse atmosphere that seems to so often translate into the really amazing innovations.
You also say there's a problem with the great man theory of innovation, which is that, you know, great ideas come from the Archimedes, from the Bill Gates, from the Steve Jobs, from the Larry Ellisons, from the Mark Zuckerbergs. And what we're waiting for is that one woman or man to come along with the great idea.
Absolutely. That, I think it's certainly clear that somebody like Steve Jobs had an amazing role at Apple and clearly had an amazing vision. But it seems there's much more than simply waiting around for the great person to show up, because we may be waiting for a very long time. When you think about how venture capitalists work, yes, there are certainly some venture capitalists who funded great companies who were very visionary themselves, but many of them were pretty smart but not off-the-charts kind of people. And yet the power is really that they created a system where there was very strong incentives. They really pushed people to work very hard. There was a very clear focus and a real urgency in terms of accomplishing a set of goals, which essentially created a system which allowed a lot of innovations to be able to emerge. So it's not just simply the person, but the environment and the system in which it works.
We're talking a lot about venture capital, and venture capital and private equity is something that you've written a lot about, and it's in the news a lot now because, of course, Mitt Romney is in the news. And I wonder, when you hear people talking about venture capital, about private equity, what do you think people's misunderstanding is in terms of the way they characterize it? Not misunderstanding in a bad or good way, but what do you think people don't understand particularly about what, say, a company like Bain would do?
So I think, first of all, it's probably important to distinguish that venture and private equity really are very different industries in many senses. You know, even though sometimes private equity guys like to call themselves venture capitalists, and certainly when you go and talk at Congress, you know, it's probably fair to say that 9 out of 10 people in the room seem sort of mixed together, or along with hedge funds and a few other things, as, you know, voodoo with money. I think when we look at what's actually being done, it's a very different kind of story. Private equity, we could talk about for a long time and the sort of evidence one way or the other. What's clear is that unlike private equity, venture capital really involves funding typically young companies, often ones which don't have any kind of revenue, much less profits at the time, and trying to transform them into something more. And clearly, venture capitalists had enormous successes. We can think of the Apples and the Intels of the world, not to mention the Facebooks, which have created an awful lot of value. But at the same time, it's clear that while it works for some things, particularly for groovy things like information technology and internet and software and social media, for a lot of stuff, which is really important technologies like that we need, things like biotech or energy, it doesn't seem that it necessarily works that well, that it seems to be very powerful in some ways, but not to really be a cure-all on the other hand.
If you're looking at then how do you support companies that are in those areas that are maybe not tech, that are not the great next gadget,
right,
what do you use to support those companies then?
Well, I think this is certainly one of the really big questions out there, because you say, you know, Peter Thiel has this line about the venture capitalists that they promised us flying cars and they ended up delivering 140 characters, right? That in a way, many of the sort of greatest promises of technology are not the newest social media app that will figure out whether your buddies are in the bar around the corner, but are really addressing the big questions that we face as a society, right? Issues around climate change, issues around health and how to deliver health services more efficiently, issues around how do we, you know, get more bang for the buck in terms of energy. The problem is that venture, in a way, the funds are set up to have a 10-year life. And typically, that means by end of year 5, the venture capitalists are getting a little nervous. They're itching. They're saying, we got to get out of this thing somehow.
Yeah, they're pressuring the people that they invested in, you know, to come up with something.
Right. And if you're doing a iPhone app company, that's great, because usually, you know, you get it out there and people get excited and they're revved up and so forth. But if you're creating some new way to turn biomass into energy, some renewable energy kind of thing, that's something that's going to take a lot of money and a lot of time to get into the marketplace. And it's probably going to be well more than the 4 or 5 years that the venture capitalist really has. So one of the really big questions is saying, how do we get some of the intensity and energy of the venture process, the kind of vision of saying, let's not just look at what we have today, and really get something that can be, you know, fund the sort of longer, bigger, you know, sometimes the venture capitalists use the phrase hairier projects that aren't really, you know, sort of as well fitted to the model as some sort of groovy new app or software product.
Not just the Nokia phone, but right, maybe that iPhone around the corner that's going to do something totally different.
Not to mention, you know, some sort of new drug that's going to cure cancer.
Exactly. We're talking about innovation and business with Josh Lerner, the professor of investment banking at Harvard Business School and author of The Architecture of Innovation, The Economics of Creative Organizations. And Josh Lerner, I want to broaden this out a little bit into government. And I wonder what you think the role of government is. I thought one really interesting thing that you say in the book is that government leaders, just like the people at Apple, can have foresight. And sometimes it comes too soon. For example, you give Jimmy Carter, you know, talked a lot about energy initiatives, for example. And some of those energy initiatives turned out to be rather prescient, but they didn't really pan out for him. So how does that work in government in terms of looking ahead to the future, but not so far ahead that people aren't there with you yet?
It's a great question, because it's clear that government has had an enormous role in terms of shaping technologies. If you just think about here in the Boston area and say, what are the two tech industries that have had the most transformative effect in recent years, you think about biotech and you think about internet. And you say both those things clearly originated in the government. It wasn't necessarily for an economic development goal, but it was either for the internet for national security or else the biotech is part of the war on cancer.
Yeah. The internet came out of the Defense Department, right? And then you have National Institutes of Health funding that, you know, been given to Harvard and to MIT. And so a lot of labs there came up with what is Kendall Square today in a lot of ways, right?
And certainly if you look at any of the other great innovation clusters that are out there, places like Silicon Valley, like Cambridge, England, you know, places, emerging places like Singapore or Shanghai, the hand of a government is very strong in terms of having played at least an initial catalytic role in terms of getting things started and getting the technology, many of the early technologies going there.
So is that the best thing that the government can do, the kind of National Science Foundation funding, the National Institutes of Health funding, or is there some other role that the government has beyond just the very beginning seed money?
I think there's really two parts to that answer. One is that clearly the government has a very important role in terms of setting the table, in terms of getting the environment right for doing this thing. Because you can look today at, you know, many countries which have, you know, great ambitions in terms of technological development, and there's just simply so many difficulties in terms of either not enough research, the technology transfer not working, the legal system not working, that you say it's just going to be very hard to get things going. But there's also a second side, which has been certainly important in the United States and Israel and many other countries as well, which is the government, if it's smart about it, can also play a role in terms of nurturing private companies, either by giving grants or contracts through procurement in a variety of other ways. So there are a bunch of things that can be done. The only problem is for every success story like Silicon Valley or Boston or Israel, you can point to a long list of, you know, rather miserable failures where governments pumped a bunch of money into something that didn't end up working very well.
So does that mean government just has to have smarter people making the judgments about where the money should be allocated?
Well, I guess I wouldn't go that far, because that would, again, just like if we have to wait for Steve Jobs to come along, waiting till we get this really genius policymaker to be at the top of the organization, we might be, you know, waiting for a long time. I think that when you look at the really successful programs that are out there, they really share certain features. And one of the big ones is, as you alluded to before, you don't want to jump into, you don't want to be too early, but you don't want to be too late either. That in an awful lot of cases, we've seen Me Too-ism. So for instance, a couple of years ago, there was a study done of programs to encourage biotech innovation in the U.S. And what it pointed out is that of the 50 states, 49 of them had programs which were based on the proposition that their state had some unique competitive advantage, which made it very well suited for being the biotech hub. And you say, well, whatever else the number is, it's probably not 49 out of 50. So there has to be some thoughtfulness of trying to say what's really realistic out there. And certainly one of the ways that seems to work the best is when instead of a government saying we're going to give a lot of money and create something out of nothing, they end up saying, let's be sure to get some matching funds from other people as a reality check. In other words, saying that, you know, however smart we are, we're probably not going to get things really right. So let's make give some money conditional on people being able to get some interest from someone else who is excited to it, because that'll suggest we're really on the right track here.
The wisdom of the crowd a little bit.
Absolutely.
Okay, I want to broaden this out and ask you a couple other questions. One is, you know, we're talking about governments, and I wonder, you look a lot at investing. When you look at China, certainly a place which has done incredibly well, but where the government has a very strong hand in business. I've heard different camps on this. Are you concerned about what you see happening in China? Do you think that their growth can continue over the next 2, 5, 10 years, or do you see a real problem coming?
Well, I think that certainly one of the things that Chinese experience illustrates is a little bit of what we saw with, you know, Japan, Korea, and many other countries, which is that the initial process of catching up is the easy part, right? That you say there's all this technology and ideas around the world. And what each of these emerging countries has done, in fact, what the United States did in the 1820s and 30s and 40s, is basically go and figure out what the other guys are doing, getting the investment. There's a very clear roadmap in terms of what to do. When you reach the point when you have gotten close to the frontier, the ideas in terms of the technologies that are there and the production approaches and so forth, clearly the getting gets very hard. And some people, and Japan is a great example, some countries have really struggled at that point. Other countries like Korea have clearly been able to get that kind of mojo. And certainly in a lot of industries like consumer electronics, Korea's, you know, considerably out of front in terms of having the kind of energy and so forth. In many industries, it's clear that China is at that point where they've certainly had, very substantial investments, a lot of capabilities there, but where in many of the industries, they've reached the frontier. So one of their big challenges, to be sure, is to move from being an imitator to an innovator. Their policy makers, when you sit down in Beijing and talk to them, they get that. They realize that this is something that's very important. But I think they're, in a way, are struggling with the same issues that we've been talking about, that in some sense, it's easy to keep track of how much money to hand out. You can hand out $1 million here and a couple $1 million here. You can measure how much money the companies spend on R&D. You can measure how many patents get taken out. But in a way, it's not about the inputs. It's about that sort of magic spark, that sort of idea that ends up being the game changer and the revolutionary one.
And they may understand when they sit down in Beijing, but if you look sort of on the street, the reality is there are companies that are heavily favored, right, because they have government connections, not necessarily because the smartest people work there or because they have the best ideas, but there is definitely favoritism. And I wonder, when you hear people who are investing, people who have spent a lot of time in China, people are putting their money there, do you sense worry? Do you sense concern?
Well, I think that certainly these are real concerns, that in a way, you know, the state-owned enterprises have a lot of resources, and in some cases, these are very effective companies, but in many cases, they are well-connected, but not necessarily the leanest and trimmest and most creative firms. So in a way, certainly, if I was sitting at the central switch trying to figure things out for them, what I would really be saying is, how do we make sure that rather than having the resources and the favors being allocated on the basis of just simply who's the biggest or the best connected, how do we make sure that really the best of the bunch. And in many cases, that means the most innovative companies get the kinds of power and resources that are really needed. It's a real challenge. And of course, again, it sort of partially reflects the fact as they're moving from one kind of scenario, the catch-up part, to a very different and probably uncharted territory.
Yeah, and you've got probably an uncomfortable communist-capitalist hybrid that sort of coexists there, too.
Well, it's an infinitely fascinating place.
Exactly. Let me come back to America for a minute. I know you've worked at Brookings and obviously also are a follower of the stock market. One of the interesting things to me, and I wonder what you make of this, is that if you look at where the stock market is now, it's just about doubled from the bottom at March 2009. But if you look at the unemployment rate since March 2009, it's no great shakes. I mean, it's come down a little bit, but it can't compete with how great the stock market has been. So I wonder, what do you see in terms of, is this just that corporate profits are doing well, people at the top are doing well, money is indeed being made, but it's not that well distributed? How do you make sense of these numbers?
Well, it's certainly a great question. And of course, if I really knew the answer to that, I would be retired in the Caribbean rather than sitting around Boston in a rainy day. It certainly the disconnect that we've seen where we've had certainly recovery, but a recovery that I think everyone would agree has been rather modest in pace, and the kind of run-up that we've seen in securities prices is really quite striking. Now, in theory, the market is efficient and it's smart and it sort of should get things right and say, you know, one interpretation would be the market sees that all the pieces are here for the recovery, that even though unemployment is a lagging indicator, that it follows whatever else is happening, that it has a sense that we're going to have real recovery and real growth going forward. On the other hand, I think that we've seen enough of history to know that the market doesn't always get it right in terms of its predictions. And, you know, certainly if you wanted to make a glummer interpretation, probably there's several out there one could run to.
And is there a possible third scenario where the market is right? It is presaging a recovery, or maybe we're in the middle of one. But it also happens that somehow, through technology, through automation, robotics, computing, a good number of people have been left behind in this recovery, maybe more people than would normally be left behind in a recovery. Do you see that as a possibility?
Absolutely. That I think there's now a pretty big body of literature that suggests that with the onset of globalization, with the the influence of information technology and so forth, the returns and the rewards for education, particularly highly educated people, have been quite positive, but many people have not benefited from that. I think the writings of Larry Katz and others would argue that this is a change that's really taken place over the last several decades, but certainly in the last few years, I think we've seen it in a particularly dramatic form.
So if you were designing political policy, what would you say to politicians in terms of, okay, well, then how do you take this reality, which is a sort of technological reality? You can't really fight the increasing power of computing, the notion that we have ATMs in our lives instead of bank tellers. That's not really something we can turn back the clock on. How would you tell them you can address this in terms of bringing down the unemployment rate? What do you need to do?
Well, this is a great question. We had a session down on U.S. competitiveness last week down in Washington, and argued back and forth for around 2 hours on this question. I think the thing that we all agreed on at the end of the day was that education is clearly a crucial element of it, that ultimately without the tools, and clearly that means skills in math and science, but also more broadly in terms of reasoning and communication and so forth, people are going to continue to find it very hard to make this transition. So that if there was one magic bullet, that would probably be it. The problem is, of course, that's a bullet you fire today and you probably get the benefits from 10 or 15 years hence.
But you think education is where probably the money should go to get people ready for a new economy, or the economy that may already be here.
Absolutely. I mean, and certainly the numbers are you know, are fairly depressing when you look at, for instance, in terms of math and science, where the U.S. and U.S. lines up today relative not just to Singapore and Shanghai, but to much of the rest of the Western world.
It's interesting, too, because we've seen companies like Foxconn, the big Taiwanese maker of different electronic components. In fact, they got a lot of attention right. for iPhones and iPads, say that they are going to bring in, hire may be the wrong word, but they are going to bring in tons of robots mm-hmm. into their factory to replace people. When you see a move like that, what does it say to you?
Well, I think that one thing it shows is that there's no real easy answer for, going back to our earlier conversation, for a country like China. You know, for certainly a long time, one of the key competitive advantages they had was very low-cost labor. But over time, both due to the kind of growth, the demand for talent, and social pressures, those wages have gone up quite considerably. And it's not surprising to sort of think about this investment in automation as, in some sense, a response to that, to those increase in wages and the like.
Well, does that make you think, both in China and in the U.S., that, you know, whatever politicians say, we are inevitably headed towards a place where there's more polarization in terms of a lot of money at the top, and maybe not as much money in the middle and at the bottom, because that's how technology is pushing it. So if you own a company, let's say, and the company has a lot of automation and robotics, that's just simply fewer people that you have to pay for health care and pay salaries of, and you get to keep more of the money.
I think that's a little unhappy interpretation. I think the happier spin that you can put on it is that the returns and the rewards for people who have the skills, who are going to be able to take advantage of these kinds of opportunities, are going to be quite substantial. That I think that we were in a static world where you just simply had, you know, a very large chunk of people who didn't have the skills to operate in this environment and they couldn't get them, you might come to this very unhappy conclusion. I guess I tend to view on the brighter side, saying that if we can really get our house in order and create a generation of people who can very much take advantage of it, that there'll be a wide variety of opportunities in terms of new firms as well as within existing firms, whole job categories that we really haven't thought about and anticipated today.
Professor Josh Lerner, talking about innovation in business. He's a professor of investment banking at Harvard Business School, and his latest book is The Architecture of Innovation, The Economics of Creative Organizations. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And coming up, we'll find out why the Nobel Committee awarded a prestigious prize this week to two scientists researching stem cells, and we'll talk about the impact that their research has had from the lab to the doctor's office. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio.